So, welcome to this deep dive tailored specifically for you, the learner. Whether you're prepping for a material science exam, brushing up on your engineering fundamentals, or, you're just curious about the hidden forces holding up the physical world around you are in the right place.
Absolutely.
We promise a fast, thorough, and hopefully fascinating journey into the microscopic architecture of iron and steel, and we're going to do it without the dreaded information overload.
Yeah, and our stack of sources today gives us just a phenomenal window into this world. We are pulling heavily from the detailed notes on the crystallography of iron by HKDH Padatia.
Right, and we're also looking at some structural models created for advanced teaching by Andrew Fairbank. Plus, we've got some stunning, really highly complex, real-world diffraction data captured by researchers like Lucy Fielding, Ed Pickering, and Payon.
It's a great mix of theory and actual experimental data.
Definitely. So our mission today is to uncover how the microscopic arrangement of iron atoms, and really crucially, the tiny spaces between them, dictate the complex reality of metals. And we are going to explore how scientists actually manage to see these invisible
It's a
structures.
lot of detective work,
You'll
honestly.
see it. Okay, let's unpack this. Before we can understand how iron behaves in the real world, like inside our suspension bridge, we first have to understand how its atoms stack together in their absolute purest form.
Right, because pure iron is kind of a shapeshifter.
The shapeshifter.
Yeah, depending on the environmental conditions, primarily temperature, really iron adopts entirely different crystal structures. The two dominant phases we are focusing on today are austenite and ferrite.
Let me set up an analogy for you, the listener, to kind of visualize this. Imagine you have a giant shipping crate and you need to pack it full of perfectly round tennis balls.
Okay, I like this.
Depending on how you arrange them, they settle into specific geometric patterns, right? So austenite is a face-centered cubic arrangement, which is also known as cubic close-packed.
Yeah, and as the name implies, it is an incredibly dense, highly organized way of stacking those atoms.
But then ferrite shifts into what's called a body-centered cubic arrangement.
Exactly. It's a slightly different geometric pattern, and crucially, it is actually less densely packed than austenite. The source notes also point out a few other variations, like a body-centered tetragonal arrangement, and even a completely different phase called epsilon iron.
Right, and I want to touch on why these shifts happen, because the atoms don't just decide to rearrange themselves for fun.
No, there's always an energetic reason.
Right. As heat increases, thermal energy forces the iron atoms to vibrate more violently. To accommodate that thermal agitation, the metal actually undergoes a phase transformation. It physically pushes the atoms out of their tightly packed body-centered cubic formation into the face-centered cubic arrangement of austenite.
Yeah, and just to add, that epsilon iron phase we mentioned, that's triggered by extreme pressure rather than heat.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, the thermodynamics of the system totally dictate the architecture. The lattice structure just alters itself to find the most thermodynamically stable configuration for whatever environment it finds itself in.
Which brings up a really practical issue. We can't exactly just put a solid piece of iron under a standard optical microscope to watch these phase changes happen in real time.
Definitely not. I mean, the wavelengths of visible light are simply too large to resolve individual atoms.
So how do they see it? The notes point out that researchers use X-ray diffraction, specifically cobalt radiation, right, and electron diffraction to map these
That's
structures.
right.
But measuring a scattered beam of radiation seems like a really indirect way to map a highly complex three-dimensional lattice.
Well, it is indirect, but it relies on some pretty fundamental physics. When you shoot a beam of X-rays or electrons at the metal, the beam penetrates the material and interacts with the regular, repeating layers of the iron atoms.
Because the atoms are arranged in planes.
Exactly. And because the wavelength of the radiation is roughly the same size as the spacing between those atoms, the beam diffracts. It scatters.
And then the scattered waves interfere with one another, right? Where the peaks of the waves align, you get constructive interference.
Yes, and that constructive interference hits a detector and creates a really specific pattern of intense spots.
So by analyzing the distances and the precise geometric angles between those spots on the detector, scientists can work backward using Bragg's law.
Yeah, Bragg's law is the key there. They reverse engineer the exact three-dimensional architecture of the atoms. It is essentially reading a microscopic fingerprint.
A microscopic fingerprint. I love that. And when scientists model these structures, like in the visual aids provided by Andrew Fairbank, they make this fascinating mathematical decision.
They do.
They assume the atomic radius of iron is fixed at exactly 124 picometers across all these different crystal structures.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is that fixing the radius at 124 picometers is a deliberate, completely necessary simplification.
Because atoms aren't actually hard tennis balls.
Right. In reality, the effective size of an atom can fluctuate slightly depending on its coordination number,
yeah,
basically how many neighbors it has.
Okay, so why lock it at 124?
Because if scientists allowed the atomic radius to function as a variable, while simultaneously trying to calculate the changing packing fractions of austenite versus ferrite, the mathematical models would just become hopelessly convoluted.
Like trying to solve an equation with too many unknowns.
Exactly. Holding the radius constant at 124 picometers acts as an anchor. It allows the underlying architectural geometry of the lattice to really take center stage without getting bogged down in minute atomic fluctuations.
Makes total sense. Okay, so we have our idealized shipping crate full of 124 picometer iron tennis balls. But pure iron on its own is relatively soft, right? It can't support a suspension bridge.
Definitely not. You'd have a very wobbly bridge.
Right. So to make steel, we have to introduce a new element into the architecture. We need carbon.
Yes. And when you introduce a smaller element like carbon into an established iron lattice, it doesn't evict the iron atoms. It just squeezes into the leftover empty gaps between them.
And those gaps are called interstices.
Yep, interstices.
So in our dense austenite structure, the notes detail that carbon can sit in an octahedral interstice or a regular tetrahedral interstice.
Right, octahedral meaning eight-sided and tetrahedral meaning four-sided.
Exactly. And in ferrite, it can sit in an octahedral interstice or an irregular tetrahedral interstice.
Which brings us to a really foundational concept in metallurgy. In ferrite, the carbon atom strongly prefers to occupy the octahedral interstice.
Okay, wait. I need to push back on the physics of this preference for a second.
To be fair.
If we look at the pure dimensions of the body-centered cubic lattice of ferrite, the tetrahedral void actually has a slightly larger continuous internal volume than the octahedral void.
It does, mathematically speaking.
So why does carbon intentionally choose a site that is technically tighter? I mean, if tetrahedral means four sides and octahedral means eight, wouldn't you just assume it goes to the wider hole?
Well, that observation cuts right to the heart of the mechanics. It's actually not strictly about the volume of the empty space. It is all about the shape of the space and the resulting strain energy.
Strain energy.
Yeah. Atomic systems always seek the state of lowest possible energy. When an intruder atom like our carbon forces its way into a lattice, it displaces the host atoms. It pushes them out of the way,
yeah,
creating strain.
Okay, let's break down that strain. In the tetrahedral site, the carbon pushes symmetrically against the four surrounding iron atoms. That causes what's called isotropic expansion.
Right. Think of isotropic expansion like inflating a high-pressure balloon inside a tightly packed box.
Okay.
It pushes outward equally in all directions, forcing every single surrounding iron atom to shift simultaneously. That generates a tremendous amount of resistance and consequently really high strain energy.
That makes sense. It's fighting everyone at once. But the octahedral site is different.
Very different.
Even though the overall volume might be tighter, the geometry means two of the iron atoms are situated very close to the carbon, while the other four are positioned much further away.
Exactly. So the carbon atom only really has to force those two close iron atoms apart. The resulting strain is tetragonal.
Tetragonal strain? So how is that different from the balloon?
Instead of a balloon expanding in all directions, it's akin to stretching a heavy rubber band primarily along one single axis.
Mm-hmm.
The lattice stretches severely in one direction, but the other axes remain relatively undisturbed.
Oh, wow. So the physical effort, the energetic cost required to warp the surrounding iron matrix is just lower when it stretches drastically in one direction rather than pushing everything outward at once?
That's it, exactly. The tetragonal strain of the octahedral gap is simply energetically cheaper than the isotropic expansion of the tetrahedral gap.
So the carbon is just choosing the path of least resistance.
Always. It is a microscopic battle of thermodynamics and physics that literally dictates the ultimate tensile strength of the steel.
That is fascinating. Okay, so we've built this pristine theoretical model of iron and carbon. But moving into the real world, elements don't just arrange themselves in perfect isolated grids, do they?
I wish they did. It would make the math a lot easier. But no.
All right. They interact, they precipitate, they bond, and they form these incredibly complex overlapping neighborhoods.
Yeah, researchers analyzing actual steel samples are essentially looking at a chaotic composite. They have to rely on advanced computer algorithms to untangle these electron diffraction patterns.
Because the patterns contain overlapping signals.
Exactly. You get overlapping signals from multiple distinct phases simultaneously.
Yeah.
You might have ferrite, austenite, and cementite all showing up at once.
Cementite.
Yeah, it's a hard, brittle compound of iron and carbon.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Our sources feature real-world diffraction data from researcher Lucy Fielding, who captured something profound regarding cementite.
Her work on this is just brilliant.
She found cementite existing in what is called a Bagaratsky orientation relative to the ferrite matrix.
The coordinate data from Fielding's work is highly, highly specific.
Right. The data proves that the 001 direction of the cementite crystal was perfectly parallel to the 211 direction of the ferrite crystal.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, the 100 direction of the cementite was parallel to the 0-11 direction of the ferrite. We should probably unpack these numbers because these are Miller indices, right?
Yes, Miller indices. They are not just random coordinates on a graph. They actually represent vectors that are perpendicular to specific crystallographic planes in three-dimensional space.
So by establishing that these specific Miller indices are parallel, Fielding's data demonstrates that the literal atomic planes of the cementite and the ferrite are sitting flush against one another.
Exactly. In a precise, repeating geometric alignment.
Let me offer an analogy for you here. Imagine walking into an old historic house and finding a secret door cut flush into a wood paneled wall.
Oh, I like where this is going.
How do you prove that the door wasn't just manufactured elsewhere and installed later, but was actually cut directly from that exact piece of the wall?
You examine the wood grain.
Right. If the intricate swirling grain of the door perfectly aligns with the grain of the surrounding wall, you possess irrefutable proof that they were originally a single entity.
The Bagaryatsky orientation is basically the matching wood grain of metallurgy.
That's so cool.
It is. That flawless crystallographic alignment proves to the researchers that the cementite didn't simply form as an independent neighbor to the ferrite. It precipitated directly out of the ferrite lattice itself as the physical conditions of the metal evolved.
So the two structures are intimately born from the exact same parent matrix.
Exactly. It's an irrefutable historical record of the metal's formation, lock in the atoms.
And Fielding's data also captured twin orientations within the ferrite crystals, right?
Yes, twin boundaries.
She observed two ferrite crystals situated right next to each other, but one lattice is rotated exactly 180 degrees relative to the other.
Right, a twin boundary is a highly specific defect where the atomic lattice essentially mirrors itself. And what's amazing is, in a system with cubic symmetry like ferrite, a 180-degree rotation is not a singular event.
What do you mean?
Mathematically, there are 24 crystallographically equivalent ways this specific rotation could be represented in three-dimensional space.
Wait, 24 ways? Because a cube has multiple rotational axes, right? So twisting it 180 degrees along different planes can result in the exact same final atomic arrangement.
Exactly. The mathematical elegance of those 24 equivalent orientations just highlights the profound underlying symmetry governing these materials.
It's like, the deeper you look into a seemingly cold, rigid block of steel,
mm-hmm.
the more it resembles this dynamic, multidimensional kaleidoscope.
That's a great way to put it.
But if these precise crystallographic orientations give scientists a historical record of the metal, we have to ask what happens when the record is forged.
Ah, yes. The anomalies.
Because the diffraction patterns sometimes play tricks on the detectors, don't they?
They absolutely do. Observational tools are inherently limited, and interpreting raw diffraction data requires acknowledging those limitations.
The sources highlight some really compelling anomalies. Researcher Ed Pickering, for example, captured a diffraction pattern featuring three distinct ferrite crystals.
But the resulting pattern contained phantom spots.
Phantom spots? You mean like ghosts in the machine?
Pretty much. They were the result of a phenomenon known as double diffraction. We mentioned earlier how the detector maps the 3D structure by calculating the angles of the diffracted beams.
Right.
The detector expects the electron beam to take a single straight ricochet off an atomic plane.
In and out.
Exactly.
Right.
But in double diffraction, the electron beam enters a sample and diffracts off crystal plane A. And then before the scattered beam can exit the material, it strikes crystal plane B and diffracts a second time.
It bounces twice.
but the detector only records the final trajectory of the beam as it exits the material.
So it mathematically traces that final trajectory backward, assuming a single scatter event.
Yes, and calculates the origin point based on that false assumption, which forces the computer to draw an atom that does not actually exist.
Wow. So the double bounce tricks the algorithm into mapping a phantom crystallographic plane.
Precisely. If a material scientist is not vigilant in looking for the geometric signatures of double diffraction, they could completely misinterpret the microscopic architecture. They might mistakenly believe they've discovered a brand new, potentially brittle phase of metal, when really it's just an optical illusion.
That is terrifying from an engineering standpoint. And it's not just the beams bouncing wrong. The physical environment of the sample itself can also corrupt the data.
Oh, definitely. Surface contamination is a huge issue.
Yeah, Payan captured a diffraction pattern from an exceptionally thin foil sample of steel. But the pattern was heavily contaminated by gamma iron oxide, specifically gamma Fe2O3.
Right, which is essentially just rust. To get these readings, the foil has to be milled down to such an extreme thinness to allow the electron beam to pass through it.
But the surface of the foil had developed this microscopic layer of oxidation.
Exactly. Now, on a massive steel I-beam, a layer of surface oxide that thin would be totally negligible. You wouldn't even factor it in.
But because the sample itself was just a microscopic sliver, the volumetric ratio completely shifted.
Yep. The ultra-thin layer of rust made a massive, highly disproportionate contribution to the overall diffraction pattern.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is a vital lesson in the rigors of material science, isn't it?
It absolutely is. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the discipline is just as much about understanding the mechanical and environmental flaws of our observational tools, whether that is double diffraction creating phantom atoms or thin foils skewing volumetric data, as it is about understanding the metal itself.
You have to know exactly when the instrument is being compromised by the environment.
Exactly. The data is only as good as your understanding of how it was gathered.
Speaking of compromised environments, we should clarify one final structural mechanism before we wrap up. We've focused extensively on carbon squeezing into the octahedral interstices, those empty gaps.
Right, the interstitial atoms.
But the notes specify that when you alloy iron with larger elements, like chromium and silicon, they behave entirely differently.
They do, because carbon is small enough to be an interstitial defect. It fits in the gaps.
But chromium and silicon are just physically too massive to fit into those gaps, regardless of the strain energy.
Exactly. So they function as substitutional atoms.
Meaning they completely evict an iron atom from its designated spot in the cubic lattice and just take its place.
Yeah, they don't hide in the empty space at all. They fundamentally alter the architecture of the shipping crate itself.
Which, I imagine, brings entirely different thermodynamic properties to the resulting steel alloy.
It changes the rules of the game entirely, yeah.
So what does this all mean? We started by standing beneath a colossal suspension bridge, assuming absolute structural permanence.
And then we tore that assumption apart.
We really did. We zoomed into a world defined by thermal agitation, empty space, and strict 124 picometer architectural constraints. We explored the physics of strain energy, where carbon dictates the strength of steel by seeking the tetragonal strain of the octahedral gap, simply because it requires less energy than isotropic expansion.
We also observed the historical records encoded in the lattice, using Miller indices and the Begerowski orientation to prove that summit-type precipitates directly from the ferrite matrix. It's written right there in the atoms.
And then we navigated the pitfalls of the scientific method itself. We learned how double diffraction and microscopic layers of gamma iron oxide can forge the structural fingerprint, forcing researchers to constantly question the integrity of their own data.
It really forces a shift in perspective.
How so?
Well, we've spent all this time analyzing how a simple 180-degree twin boundary, an invisible layer of surface oxide, or a phantom atom calculated from a deflected electron beam, can fundamentally alter the structural reality of iron in a lab.
Right.
It makes you wonder, as you look at the engineered environment around you right now, how much of our understanding of the everyday solid objects we rely on might actually be hiding behind similar microscopic optical illusions?
Oh, wow. That is a profound shift in perspective. The next time you walk across a steel bridge, you are definitely going to be thinking about all those invisible carbon atoms stretching out those octahedral gaps locked in this microscopic battle of physics.
You'll never look at a piece of metal the same way again.
Definitely not. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden crystallography of iron. We love taking these analytical journeys with you. Until next time, keep questioning the world around you.
Thank you for joining us.